to me to recognize that. The contrast I would make here would have to do with Libeskind's excess of form versus Speer's absence of form. It's been pointed out, for example, that Speer's most successful buildings were temporary structures. To quote Dalthau again, in Speer's edifices, there was no sense of mourning. They lived by their own absence of form and were nourished only in terms of the overflowing of their own dimensions. The second correspondence that I would point out regards Michael Hayes's critique of the architecture of Tessenow and the way in which Tessenow's aesthetic theories of effective engagement, a kind of recognition of architecture's ability to direct and engage perception as actually participating in a kind of proto-fascist construction. Now, again, in the case of Libeskind, this is clearly an architecture of effective engagement, devoted to engaging and manipulating the perceptions of the viewer. What I would suggest, again, that the difference that could be constructed would be this: that with Tessenow, the effective engagement of the viewer is always directed towards a specific goal. In the case of Libeskind, the viewer is presented with simultaneous and contradictory engagements, which in the end, it seems to me, force the visitor to choose rather than manipulate his or her point of view. I want to talk a little bit about the problem process, and I will go over this quite quickly, because it seems to me here is another instance of Libeskind's critique of modernism, that in recent practice, the modernist notion of a self-justifying process is understood either as a check on the irrational subjectivity of the author or as a strategy after Barth, Cage, or Foucault to cancel out the hand of the author. And Libeskind's early work seems to me came close to this notion. We were presented with the evidence of a work which appeared to be the result of a process, but without the comfort of being able to trace that process back in a linear fashion. In the case of Libeskind's project for the Jewish Museum, as Mark Taylor has described, he triangulated a series of dresses in Berlin, produced this six-pointed star, and then collapsed that back onto itself. Now, I would say that in this case, it's not an attempt to suggest that in the final object, the possibility of reconstructing its process still exists. Nor do I think that Libeskind intends us to read the moments of this process, which are, of course, highly symbolic, whether he intends us to read them simply as symbolic form. And I would underline this point by looking actually at the kind of looseness of Libeskind's process. That is to say, the way in which, if we actually begin to try and trace these processes back in a linear fashion, we end up being actually completely frustrated in that attempt. I would say instead that the sequence of these operations is simply stated as a fact of their making, and that the process has the character of a demonstration like Duchamp's three standard stoppages. With this loose process and through its exercise, Libeskind signals his paradoxical faith in a modernist language, which he knows to be all but exhausted. Now, there's an additional irony, it seems to me, in so much as the outward form of the building appears as a kind of exaggerated parody of the culture bunker. That is to say, that most conservative form of the modern museum, the blank neutral box with which the post-war apparatus of the culture industry has typically presented itself, military metaphor intended and intact. Now, I would like to think that this is a conscious decision on Libeskind's part, much as Schoenberg chose a stylized decorative form identified with, say, Wagner or Verdi as a vehicle for the meditation on abstraction and representation in Moses and Aaron. Or would it be possible to say that Libeskind, like Kafka, works to deterritorialize the form from within, a form which he inhabits uneasily? As George Steiner remarked of Kafka nearly 30 years ago, anticipating Deleuze and Guattari's characterization of a minor literature, Kafka was inside the German language, as is the traveler in a hotel. The House of Words was not truly his own. And I want to show more studies of the facade and details of the construction. I want to extend this notion, actually, to an additional problem, that is to say, as the project develops and as Libeskind begins to produce drawings like these and the building begins to be enveloped within the kind of dominant conventions of architectural representation and construction, where does that leave the project? How does Libeskind negotiate between models like this and drawings like this? That seems to me to be one of the more difficult questions raised by the project. In part, I think it's by extending and working at all levels of that process, working within the bureaucratic apparatus, working through the program, that Libeskind begins to deal with that. I think there's another problem here with the project, one which I sit here and talk about the project and am inevitably complicit. That is to say that the project, not yet under construction, has already received an incredible amount of attention. Glossy publications, articles, books, conferences like these, that nobody understands better than Libeskind how to choreograph a strategy of publicity. What I would argue is this, and I show this is perhaps a low blow, but this is the back of A plus U in February, where this Japanese construction company uses Daniel Libeskind's Osaka Folly as an advertisement. What I would suggest is this. The project is perhaps already consumed within architectural culture, which may in turn be the only way to rescue it. That is to say, its image is finally so naturalized that the experience of the architecture itself cannot help but be both a shock and a disappointment. I must admit, I've spent a lot of time studying this project, and it's beginning to look very normal to me. Just to conclude here, in her book, The Body in Pain, Elaine Scarry notes the inversion of architecture's sheltering capacity in the unmaking of the world of victims of torture. In the case of the Holocaust, words which designate benign domestic equipment return to haunt us: ovens, showers, lampshades, and soap. To quote Scarry, the unmaking of civilization inevitably requires a return to and mutilation of the domestic, the ground of all making. The architect enters this territory at risk, but without this risk, there is no possibility of architecture. It must be obvious by now that despite everything, there is a great deal of optimism in Libeskind's project. Libeskind has written of Aldo Rossi that he dared to probe the fundamental question whether the no longer of modern architecture actually belongs to its very own not yet. It's difficult not to extend this anticipatory claim to Libeskind's own work. Libeskind, like Rossi, refuses the cynical resignation of the no longer, preferring the more difficult but still hopeful not yet. I would locate his optimism in precisely two places. First is his faith that the practice of architecture, if interrogated with sufficient radicality, if reinterpreted with sufficient creativity, can renegotiate its conventional compromises with institutionality, with metaphysics, physics, with rationality. He expresses a confidence that architecture, in turn, can sustain a legible poetic such that it might be capable of confronting the most profound and tragic events of this century. The second is Libeskind's faith that he, as an individual author, can conduct this interrogation, interpret its results, make it public, make it legible, without implicating himself in a suspect metaphysics of the heroic creator. And it is this moment, it seems to me, that Libeskind is most vulnerable to critique, that he's situating his project uncritically in the territory of a high modernism, understood both as historical designation and in opposition of mass culture. To accomplish this, does Libeskind need to preserve the autonomous subject and uphold a metaphysic of power in the face, a metaphysic of the power of the individual face to face with history? success or failure in terms of the architect's intentions may be perhaps the least interesting judgments we could make of this project. Architecture's condition in the world, outside the control of its author, and outside of the immediate protection of the institution, confers on the building a special kind of limited autonomy, imposing necessity for continual re-examination and revision. So with regard to the other question asked by our symposium organizers, are the traditional modes of representation valid, or do they produce a violent disfiguration in rewriting the Holocaust? I would answer as follows. All forms of representation produce a more or less violent disfiguration. The task is how to divert and interrogate the simple violence of writing, the simple violence of designing, the simple violence of building. To follow, in other words, Maurice Blanchot's injunction, write in order not simply to destroy, in order not simply to conserve, in order not to transmit. Write in the thrall of the impossible real, that share of disaster wherein every reality, safe and sound, sinks. Thank you. I'm afraid I've overstayed my time, but I'll answer some questions.
I would just like to thank you for following in a difficult position and taking a project that we talked about, yet still pulling out aspects of it, particularly the aspects of the very difficult problem of taking theory and working on and doing practice. And it's on those lines that I'd like to ask a question about the very idea of the institution of a museum and how or does Leveson negotiate with the history of the museum and with this relationship with the construction of a particular national identity. Is he or is anyone within producing a museum caught within its institutional boundaries, unable to work itself out so that the form of play, as soon as the label gets put on, just becomes simply that, a form of play?
Yeah, no, I think that as you point out, I mean, the museum is always implicated right from the beginning in a kind of imperialist discourse. I mean this is the museum as an institution emerges in the 18th and 19th centuries, sort of precisely at this moment, and with this not explicit intention, but as a part of these same cultural and political formations. So the first answer is yes. I mean, the problem is always going to haunt anyone who works today within the context of the museum. I would say a couple of things. I mean, one is the necessity to recognize the way, let's say, even in the past 20 years, the institution of the museum has changed. That is to say, since the post-war period and the kind of incorporation into the museum of the avant-garde and the extension of a kind of culture of spectacle to actually incorporate the museum itself. So that we look at the institution of the museum today, it seems to me it can no longer simply be adequately described by the conventional description and critique, which sees it as a centralizing institution upholding established discourse and power. That even if one looks at the way in which exhibitions are packaged and presented and sold, for example, that one has to recognize the negotiation involved with cultures of consumption and spectacle and so on. Which is not to say that that gets the architect or the museum people off the hook, but rather that it changes the terms within which their work has to be evaluated. Whether Libeskind adequately gets out of that bind, I would say, in a certain sense, I mean, I think he's caught within it. I mean, this is when I say that he's still situates his project in a kind of high modernist framework. I think in that sense, he understands the museum that way and the critique of the museum that way.
In terms of parallel of the Schoenberger and the Leveson, as I know, in terms of the formal issue, Schubert destroyed the P system in music, and he established the 12-tone mm-hmm. system. Okay, and as a result, to my knowledge, the 12 system music has not been popularized
right.
in the music field. And most of them, you know, I would say, widely used in the horror film. You know, that suddenly all devil or ghost
yeah.
appears, they use that stuff. And on the other hand, the classic system, I mean the P system, is widely used, still very popularized. Almost every song still in that system, and they provide as a very effective tool to show the uniqueness of each composer. It's, you know, to provide as a tool to be recognized easily by the public. So is there any indication that the Liebsken system, I mean the formal system,
yeah.
will have the future that is still parallel to the Schoenberger system?
Well, see, again, I mean Schoenberg in music coincides with the moment of high modernism and the possibility of systematization of a new compositional mode, and which of course now, I mean, certainly the discussion among composers, consists almost entirely not of going back to the classical system, but rather of finding new ways to work after Schoenberg and after this. And I think one of the arguments is that Schoenberg's systematicity is every bit as confining limiting as the classical system. I mean, again, at a very superficial level. Now, again, I would put the question in terms of Liebeskind's allegiance to a moment of high modernism, to pre-war abstraction, and frame that then in relationship to certain postmodern practices that deal with, for example, text and narrative and the performative, all of the some of the aspects mentioned, for example, in James's talk, and frame the critique of Liebeskind's work in terms of his faithfulness to that one particular moment of high modernist discourse, but within his own discipline, not in terms of the analogy to music, but in terms of Liebeskind's faithfulness to a language laid out by, say, Mussorgsky, Malevich,